You said you didn't have much to do with the other ranks. I mean,
well, let me take as an illustration. I came back from a weekend leave in London, where I had been staying at the Royal Artillery Mess in Woolwich. The Royal Artillery Mess in Woolwich encouraged people to go and stay there because it was because it was 1 shilling for bed and breakfast. And so if there were officers spending time in London, they would obviously spend them at the mess, which was good for the regiment. And I came back on the Sunday night, and I had not looked at the orders, and the result was I was awoken peremptorily on the Monday morning to find that I should have been on parade taking a draft of soldiery down to Southampton to catch a troopship. So I dressed with speed and caught the train. Before the war, one of the places where we recruited soldiers for the regular army was Ireland, there were some of these Irishmen who were being difficult, being inclined to support the IRA, I believe, and they were being shipped out on this troop ship to reinforce units in Palestine, where we were having trouble with the Arabs and the Arab revolt at the time. And I had this group of soldiers, and we took them in a special coach on the train from Amesbury, and the coach was shunted onto another train and eventually finished up alongside the in Southampton. And the soldiers were paraded, and to my alarm and concern, there was one short. But he fell in as he came out of the the convenience that he'd been into under the platform, and that was in order. Again, the warrant officers had seen to it that I would be looked after. They had detailed soldiers to look after others, and the people who had spent the few days in the guardroom before they were put on the troop train were looked after by other soldiers to make sure that they were going to be there and put onto the ship. There was the army is a great thing for organising. We had, when I was in Plymouth, a test mobilisation, and that was a remarkably busy time, and I always seemed to be rushing around to this place to collect this and that place to collect whatever and get the stores in from somewhere else. When the real mobilisation happened some months on, I found I had nothing whatever to do because the soldiers knew what had to be done and they could do what was required without intervention by officers.
Now, what about your actual training in gunnery? Both sort of, were you actually taught gun drill just as an exercise so that you knew what was going on? And what about the sort of mathematical elements of gunnery ranging?
I was never taught very much about gun drill, and I was, remember, by far the most junior subaltern, and the tasks that I had were the tasks that you require to get guns and vehicles from place to place and organised. I was very adept at answering the colonel's question, "Where are you?" by showing him on the map where I was, and I did not make the mistake that other young officers did, but saying they were somewhere along the road here or whatever. I was always confident where we were, so I knew a lot about the problems of movement. My gunnery training did not come until later on.
So you had an administrative role at the time?
I mean, well, I was the junior subaltern, the dog's body, who did what was required. I mean, if there was any ordering of gunfire, this would be done by the battery commander. The subaltern's job was.
Now, what guns and vehicles did you have to organise the movement of?
The gun was an 8-inch howitzer. It was fitted with rubber tyres, and so it was. It bounced along quite happily on the main roads at 20 odd miles an hour, 25 miles an hour probably. The vehicles were Scammels, which had towing gear, and they were very able to go across country, and there was excellent cross country performance. I was quite adept at seeing that guns got into the right place and under control. And
were they actually gun towers, or were they just lorries?
A Scammel is a lorry. A Scammel was the maker's name, They were Gardner diesel engines, and they towed a gun behind. And you had two Scammels per gun. One was towing the gun, another was towing all the tackle that was required by the gun, because it would require a mounting, a frame to fire from. And of course, there was both vehicles would be carrying ammunition, so there was quite a large number.
The ammunition would be in the lorry rather than towed on a limber.
No, it was not on a limber. No, it was in the lorry. There were no limbers on heavy guns. The gun, I don't know what it weighed, but it would be some tons of weight.
Now, anything else? I mean, so you went. You were at the Easter vacation break, where you were mainly on the air cooperation course. And then
that lasted a few days. Don't exaggerate. I mean, the air cooperation course would have lasted, I suppose, 4 or 5 days at most, including getting there and getting back and making the acquaintance of the Royal Horse Artillery for the first time, who I stayed with for the course.
And the rest was just normal training. And then you went back in the summer,
when I went back in the summer, by now, the regiment was not at Plymouth. They were in camp at Lark Hill, and that was where we were trained on field and moving artillery from place to place. I don't remember that we did any firing. I don't think we did any firing that year. I know that my fellow subalterns pointed out to me that this was the first year that they had not been taken in the cages of captive balloons for the training of artillery controlling fire from a captive balloon, but that technique had gone, although I found when I came to the war with the Germans that the Germans still had it. But
now, anything else about your training before? Because I'd quite like to talk a bit about your time at university. You were at Queen's College.
Queen's College, yes. And I studied philosophy, politics, and economics. My tutor was an American from Arizona. I explained to him when we had lunch together in my first weeks that I was an army reservist and didn't expect to get through my 3 years at Oxford without being called into the service. And he said, for his part, he wasn't sure that I would get through my first year without being called for service, which encouraged me to get on with my preliminary training. And the preliminary training, as I've told you, I did in the long vacation, and the colonel of the regiment wrote the confidential report ending with the I would be prepared to take this officer on active service tomorrow, and 10 days later he was, which was...
Now, let me talk just a bit about what was it like as a young undergraduate at Queen's?
It was a very comfortable life. I got myself involved in a number of activities.
Firstly, the course. Did you find the course satisfying? I mean, was it what you'd hoped it would be?
Yes. I was starting to make my way into philosophy. You perhaps know the name of Iris Murdoch, the lady who wrote the novels, and that she and I used to attend lectures together in philosophy. We both started our philosophy at the same time. There was a by-election in Oxford, and our philosophy tutor, Lindsay, who was the Master of Balliol, stood for the anti-Nazi, I forget the words, but he was a campaign against the German Nazi Party. In those days, the Conservatives were into appeasement, and the Labour Party was into pacifism, and the Liberal Party didn't amount to anything. He stood for Parliament and among those people who tried to ensure that he was elected was Iris Murdoch and I. We campaigned together. I don't suppose we actually made any change in the voting system, but it was my introduction to politics. I found the course was stimulating and interesting, and I was good at it, so there's no problem to me.
And what about the social life at the time?
I found that perfectly easy. I have always... I went to the Bradford Grammar School, as you know, and there is a difference between the people who went to the Charterhouses and the Eatons of this world. That was the case in the army. It was the case in the college. But so what? I mean, people are not necessarily all the same, are they? They presented me with no problem. I will admit that I spent my time with the people who are of the grammar school type rather than the public school type, and people tend to flock with their same kind, don't they?
But it sounds like there wasn't any animosity between the two groups.
I don't think so. They were different. I mean, you laughed at them occasionally. I think probably the person who is most out of line, I remember an American from Georgia who was a Rhodes Scholar who had a loud and boisterous voice and the most politically incorrect views on niggers and the like, which who could wish for. But,
What about other aspects of your political life? Were you taking... I mean, you decided to join the army on the... did you take a very great interest in the rise of Hitler? Could you perhaps talk a bit about your sources of information, why it affected...
Well, I didn't know anything about the army during my college time. My college time, I was learning my subjects... and I was also very actively interested in politics because I was strongly opposed to the established parties, and I took the view that something had to be done about Hitler, and so I was there was a campaign to raise money for the Chinese who were suffering desperately at the hands of the Japanese. There was a terrible siege of Nanking, which where the massacre went on for a week or 10 days after the city had fallen, and indeed, I suppose, justified our minds, the Hiroshimas and Nagasakis, because the flash of the bomb in the few seconds it took the Japanese a week or 10 days to achieve in Nanking, and there was a campaign through the country to raise money for the Chinese. It was undertaken by the Christian Church, amongst other people, and I organised the collection in my college in Queens, getting some one person to collect the money from each staircase in the college. I remember one of my contemporaries, not perhaps one of your brightest listeners, Alaric Hine by name, now dead, he was... collecting on one staircase, and we had one Japanese student in college, and he had not got the wit to realize that he was Japanese, and he escaped narrowly mistreatment at the hands of the Japanese when he started to regret the behavior of the Japanese in China.
Anything else? Any other political campaigns you're involved with? Or
I did take part in a number of political things. If you read Dennis Healey's biography, he was involved at this time in organising a public meeting in Oxford. I, at that time, the same time that he was doing that, I was demonstrating on the streets of London.
What was the demonstration about?
It was about the war, the possibility of the war, and taking a stronger line with Hitler. I'm not very sure now. I remember that I was actively involved with one of the university societies to do with the Third World. I remember being involved with Indian students, the Marjories, who were concerned with the... But it was a long time ago. I don't think it amounted to too much.
But you weren't formally aligned to any of the political parties? Obviously not the main ones, you said that, but not...
I belonged to the Oxford University Labour Club. Oxford University Labour Club was, I think, probably the largest organisation in Oxford at that time, having thousands of supporters. I attended their dances and that sort of thing.
Did... But you
had Dennis Healy again, as I've told you, there was a man called Bellamy at Queen's who had been at school with me. He was very actively of the left, and indeed I think remained a member of the communist organisation probably most of his life. Another of my Oxford contemporaries, a man called Boris, who was later professor of Russian at Leeds University. He used to complain to me once about the fact that the Russian government would have social visits to Russia of people like his colleague Bellamy, who was the communist and who taught economics at Leeds University, whereas he, who taught Russian language, was not invited.
I thought you disapproved of some of the Labour Party policy at the time on Germany, the pacifist time. I mean, there were many different angles, weren't there?
The line of Longford or Pakenham was a pacifist one. That was would certainly keep me away from the Labour Party.
So, because the University Labour Club was not actually part of the Labour Party, was it?
It certainly wouldn't be part of the Labour Party, no. There were people who were affiliated to the Labour Party, and there were certainly communists like Dennis Healy that we've talked about before. He was an active member of the Labour Party and also an active communist at that time.
But you weren't.
Not like that, no. Be an active communist and a member of the army, could you? I was a second lieutenant in the army.
Now, what about the actual outbreak? I mean, you're becoming... This would be in... Would it be your end of your first year?
At the end of the first year, I completed my military training, and indeed I had intended that I would have gone with a friend of mine to do some cycling in Normandy, but the war got in the way, and I never did my cycling in Normandy.
Now, what do you remember of the call-up? What day were you? Were you called up on the 1st with the Territorials, or were you called up before?
The army was mobilised, I think it was somewhere about the 24th or 22nd of August, and so I had my call-up papers, and I had my emergency railway ticket. I remember going through London, probably St Pancras, and I remember one of the railway men offering to be my valet, Batman, if I would take him with me. But and I reported to the camp on Lark Hill, where the regiment had been when I was doing my training.
So they hadn't moved, they were still
there? No, they were still there.
Do you know the name of the camp at Lark Hill?
Fargo, F-A-R-G-O, Fargo Camp. It was a tented camp, but there were some hutted buildings not fitted with electric light. And it was there where we mobilised and received the men from the reserve who came to increase our numbers that we could...
Now, what do you remember of the mobilisation process? As you said, it went very smoothly, because
that was the physical part of getting the gear. But, of course, on mobilisation, you've got a whole lot of soldiers and officers arriving, and they have got to be assimilated and sorted out. I can remember my Sergeant Major... Well, on mobilisation, one of the first tasks that I was given by my Sergeant Major was to increase the number of drivers, which we were always very short of, and I was given a vehicle and half a dozen men and told to pass their driving test for me. And I can remember one of these drivers in Salisbury, I suppose. We paused at the entrance to a busy road, and there was traffic going by, and regardless of the traffic, suddenly he let the gear in and we charged forward, striking another vehicle in the process. I remember he failed his test, so I did get back with some past drivers. I remember the Sergeant Major also...
Were you training them as well as testing them?
No, I was testing them. I was just told to pass them. They had received their instruction, and it was my job to do the testing. carry out the various tests that one has to make of a driver to see if he can drive.
What else do you remember about the mobilisation process and the problems of this influx of new men?
There were these men who arrived from the reserve, and I remember the sergeant major falling them in, and he asked how many were drivers, and most of them were, and then he suddenly had a thought and asked whether they were drivers RA. Well, they were. Drivers RA are people who control horses, they don't drive vehicles. The sergeant major was very disappointed about that. And then, of course, there were these officers who turned up, some of whom had not been in the army since they were demobilised after the First War, others who were on leave from places like Singapore. And so you had improbable stories. There was a man, I remember, who talked about indiscipline, or worse, after the First War. There was the occasion, it seems, when he got back to the mess to find a number of angry soldiery around it, and said, "What were they doing?" And they said they were going to burn the mess down. He said, "Well, give me 5 minutes to get my kit out," and so he got his kit out before they burnt the mess down. But that would be in the 1919s or 1920, I don't know when that was. There was, of course, the man on leave from Singapore with racy accounts of the feminine facilities available to the soldiery, and also strange stories of there was coast artillery, and there had been an occasion on which someone had proof tested a 15-inch gun and had succeeded in blowing away most of the temporary accommodation that had been required by the civilian workmen who had been erecting the gun position, which was regarded as a light-hearted mistake. But yes, so there was a lot of getting to know, and the other people, there were men.
Competent officers, because, you know, they're competent either physically, if they're older, you know.
Well, they all came with artillery experience, a varied artillery experience, and therefore it was the task of my battery commanders and the regimental commanders to sort out who they wanted. They wanted me. A battery was commanded by a major. He had a captain who was responsible for seeing to the administration side of things and the quartermaster side of things, and two subalterns. So it wasn't rocket science to find four men who would carry out the duties that you were required to carry out in a battery of four 8-inch howitzers or 6-inch Mark 19 guns, and the radio sets that went therewith. We had that to do, and they had to sort out. They were also, as well as finding men for our own units, they were also creating new units that didn't exist in peacetime. There were super heavy artillery that was going to shoot from railway lines, and they also were going through the same sorting process. But there was never any question that they wanted me in a subaltern-like role, particularly as I had recently, freshly done all the up-to-date stuff about artillery movements, and I was also familiar with the use of radio. And
well, that's just what I was going to ask. Yeah. I was going to ask about about whether you'd had much signal or wireless training.
Yes, I'd used the gear. I had not had specialist training on signalling, and indeed my knowledge of the Morse code was not very good. But then we were just moving from the wireless telegraphy to the radio telephony stage, and most of the stuff was done on radio.
Do you know which wireless set it was?
Number one. We used the number one. And indeed, I think one of the things that happened when we mobilised, we got the number 11, which is hierarchically the one that comes after the 1 series. It's 1, 11, 21, 31, and so on in generation terms.
And What did you learn? I mean, it was obviously, it wasn't so much training, it was more familiarisation. What was there to learn about the wireless?
To make use of it effectively and to not allow yourself to do things which would enable people to detect who you were. You always had to be alert to detection finding and other gaining of information.
So you'd use call signs and things like that?
Oh, indeed, yes. Call signs and code signs, and there were also a whole range of code books for sending information in code. All of that I was familiar with from my field manoeuvres in the Aldershot and Lark Hill area.
What could be done about direction finding, though? Because surely they could just... What could you do to stop them triangulating on your...
Just not use the set. So you didn't use the set unless you had to. I was telling you that one of the things that I was into was the Southern Command manoeuvres. Winchester had a brand new bypass, and it was not in use, but they opened it so that my guns would go around the bypass and not through the town of Winchester.
Now, so you were doing this process of mobilisation was going on, and did anything else happen before the war actually broke out on the 3rd of September?
Well, as soon as we mobilised, I was telling you that we were sorting ourselves out as to who was going to do what, and therefore people were also getting themselves adjusted. And I can remember one of the things that I did was to take my battery commander's car to lay it up in a garage for him. He did warn me to keep the speed down. I did go faster than he said, and the car had the amazing habit of moving suddenly sideways if you went too fast, because transverse suspension has curious habits. I got it safely to his place. The weekend before we took our boats to France,
What about the actual outbreak of war, though? What do you remember?
Oh, well, that happened when I was called up. The first things to do was to get through the inoculations of tetanus and typhoid and whatever else. The Sunday morning that Neville Chamberlain said that we were now in a state of war came over the loudspeakers from one of the tented battery offices as I walked past, so I heard it going out. I've talked to you before about my Sutherland colleagues who are into horses. As soon as we were at war, and you now had the opportunity to write your wills without the need of solicitors and witnesses and the like, carrying the magic words when on active service. I remember the subalterns were all heavily engaged in writing their wills, which seemed to be mainly composed of what was going to be done with their horse tackle, which was the one thing that subalterns possessed.
Did you write your will?
I didn't write a will, no. I had no possessions.
Now, so what happened? What impact did the actual outbreak have? You'd been expecting it, obviously.
Yes, I mean, everybody in Britain had been expecting it, and it cleared the mind wonderfully, I suppose, and you started taking consideration as to where one was, as it were.
So what happened next then?
No, when we mobilised, we sent our vehicles and guns to the Avonmouth area to be put on the long sea crossing from the Bristol Channel down to Nantes, and the soldiery that weren't going with the guns and vehicles were on the short sea crossing from Southampton to Cherbourg.
Now, was this a particular responsibility of yours?
I was one of the. I was not involved in the vehicle movement. There was a slightly amusing. One of the other things.